You are listening to a Triple Canopy podcast. To hear more, visit www.canopycanopycanopy.com.
So, first I have to apologize for that terrible voice. It happened only today, but I hope you get along with it. So I just want to add, maybe so that it's not really too frustrating for you not to be able to read the book, that there is a text by Baroda Tude, which is available on social, like third text. David Joselit's text is available in Dada Diagrams, and a text by Bracha Ettinger is available also on the internet. It's called Poesis, and you can download it. So there already, like, half of the book is somehow, you can kind of put it together by yourself. I just want to say maybe like how I came across that like topic of diagram. And it was, in a way, it was a kind of a fascination, I think, and maybe we are all talking here from a kind of a fan perspective. So on the one hand, the kind of like fascination with that promise of order, beauty, balance. On the other hand, like knowing that this is really annoying because usually never is true, that like the world is maybe not that simple as in medieval age they like put like the four elements in relation to the four winds or stuff like that. Or there's also, for example, and I came across like an Alain Badiou's is the logic of worlds. You go like through, I didn't, but you are supposed to read like 600 pages. And at the very end, you have a very little diagram, which means to sum up the whole book. And then you say, okay, so how is that possible? And it's kind of really kind of misrelation between text, meaning, and then the promise of like containment in a diagram. I think this is something which intrigued me to a little bit do some further studies. And then I kind of realized that... But the diagram also, can be also very like a banal thing. For example, that's why I chose this penguin just as an entry image, because it shows a Feynman diagram. But to illustrate why it's called penguin diagram, they just put that penguin behind. So for me, the important thing is maybe not the not the diagram itself, but the connectivity between a completely different field of visuality, let's say animal photography, and physical, a physical diagram, which actually produces a different diagram, which turns out is a kind of a joke. But beyond that, kind of like maybe also visual, being intrigued by the visuality of diagrams or the beauty of a line, there's a very important thing to diagrams, and that they are neither images nor text. So in a way, there's a kind of third logic behind it. And it's kind of interesting that this kind of had been like neglected for a longer period. I mean, it's a very basic operation. A diagram is basically about connecting things and relating things. And this is this kind of basic operation maybe has been also left out because either by the printing history, because, for example, if you see look at Peirce's manuscripts, which the scholar Benjamin Meyer Kramer did, he did a lot of doodles at the side of his manuscripts and notebooks, but they were always left out of the printing process because, like, the Gutenberg galaxy kind of couldn't cope with this doodle thing at the side. So it was only like text which was kind of reproduced. And in a way, a history is kind of a little bit, cancelled out of our thinking about, text and image. To go closer to the book, then I also realized that maybe there's a lot of studies done in terms of like visual sciences, or what we call in German like image sciences, on diagrams, especially in scientific fields, that there's hardly anything done on diagrams in art, or at least not collected. There are many like various essays around, but not a book which kind of gives an overview or tries to collect some essays. So that's what the book attempts, but not in a way that I want to be like complete or so. But actually, it shifts around like one figure of thought, you maybe could call it. And this is kind of between two notions of the diagram. And one comes from Foucault. in Discipline and Punish, where he points out the panopticon as a diagrammatic form of architecture. But he takes it further, and the panopticon, you know, that this kind of architectural form where you have one the possibility of surveying or surveillance of all the imprisoners from one perspective, but they have not the possibility to look back. So this is a kind of a way how to place people and to how to establish hierarchies. So Foucault calls this architectonical or architecture not only an architecture, but a form of political technology. And I think this is a kind of an interesting term. And just to quote it, it's a type of implanting bodies in space, of dividing of individuals and their relations to one another, of the hierarchical organization, of the arrangement of centers and channels of power, of the definition of instruments and intervention of tactics of power. And, for example, one scholar who also contributed to the book, Benjamin Buchlo, he especially refers to that kind of power notion of a diagram as something, as a tool of power, basically. But there's another a turning point or a shifter, which is much more kind of a more liberating or in empowering notion of the diagram, which comes from Deleuze and Guattari. And Deleuze's notion of a diagram is basically that the diagram is a zone of indeterminacy. And diagrams are like shifters. And they displace meanings. They dissolve stability. And they are a tool of transformation. And just a quote, a diagram destroys form and replaces it with different relations. Or various relations, actually. So in a way, which makes sense, to connect these kind of two notions of the diagram, because the Foucauldian diagram is also what I said, you place people in a room. There's already a very special order, we are placed now towards the audience. But this could be always turn around. If I just turn around, you would kind of open the space up and kind of. So this is basically this very a very simple operation, but you have to do it and you have to kind of put it into reality or perform it in a way. Yes, this is, in a way, I thought this is a good example how to look at art and to see, in a way, how they maybe take a various, more power-coded notion of the diagram towards different forms. And just to give some examples that you know what I'm talking about. So this is a kind of the invention of a diagram, which corresponds to something which Astrid Schmidt-Burkhardt in her text in the book calls the commodification of the senses or the economization of the senses. And this is a diagram from the French engineer Charles-Joseph Minard, and he was he invented this kind of flow charts. And on the upper side you see it's a coal, the coal export from England, below you see the French, Napoleon's war in Russia. So you see it's kind of very, and it completely changes the notion of history if you just think of history as a kind of a transformation of masses. And that's basically what he did. So he kind of took that very economic device, and he was as an engineer responsible for the transport of goods in France through railway and on canals. So he made that history diagram, basically saying that you see the masses, how many soldiers left Paris, went to Russia, and then you see that very tiny figure coming back. And he relates that to the kind of to the degrees, minus how many minus degrees were, and how many soldiers died at which point. So this is a kind of a very, economic way of telling history, where you see that individuals are kind of crossed out, but still it's a very new form of relating things. Then this is a kind of a next step, which is it's an advertisement from the 1945, and it says outstanding advertising can be prepared best when everyone concerned with it has a fanatical belief that sales curves bending upward is one of the world's most beautiful pictures. So this is, in a way, you see, and this is just an advertisement. So this advertising company advertises for itself. So by replacing other images by that kind of diagrammatical thing. So this is the way Astrid Schmidt-Burkhardt conceives of the kind of like economization of the senses, that everything has to be as much information as possible on one place. And there we already have like an example of David's text, where he, when you maybe also could add something just very, very briefly, of Duchamp's Unhappy Ready-Made. Basically replacing a very rational form of diagram, like from mathematics, by a diagram caused by the weather, by chance. And this is only like the first page of his text, so there are 20 more to follow. But just to give you a little idea. And then you have kind of like a text by Tom Hollard, who is also sometimes a contributor for Art Forum, maybe you know his name. He wrote a text on a fine flair for the diagram, Arakawa, Smithson, and Mel Bochner. And at this point, you already see how in art, in a way, diagrams are turned into like kind of an excessive thing. I mean, it's even more about understanding what's really going on in these scientific diagrams. Robert Smithson puts like next to that. Renaissance image, but in a way it's about confronting different modes of visualization. And on the left hand, it's the Nine Evening Theatre and Engineering catalog cover, where you also have this kind of, I think the point here is the kind of excessivity, and no longer following that thinking or this economization, which is no longer possible. And like Tom Wollard at the same time, which kind of tries to see that there was a kind of a hype of the diagram, though like a floor map is not actually like a real diagram, but still all the galleries started to kind of advertise with floor maps, which is kind of interesting. At the very same time, diagrams got very popular in conceptual art. Then we have a different form of excessivity in a way. This is a diagram by Bureau d'Etudes, which is a kind of a information guerrilla from France, who do that, all these diagrams. You can download them, actually. And this is one example, like how the individual is like split up into many kind of doubles. You see a psychological double or a biological double. And it's all about, in a way, how we are inscribed with our like cells, even like into larger systems of corporations. So he uses they use diagrams still as a kind of a tool of information and enlightenment in a way, but also as a tool of like acting and maybe changing, because you have all like different possible ways to go, and you always can make a choice. I don't know whether I should really get into it, but just very briefly, I learned to drive, I travel by car. That means that I use oil for transportation. That means that I provoke some wars for oil. I finance weapon industries. So in a way, you see where it leads to, and you see where there might be a point of interruption or maybe not going that way. Well, this is a painting by Amy. You talk about your access to the diagram later, so I just go further. And this is which is also like you again see in a way how artists take that more sense-making, rational form of diagrams completely different. So at the right side below, you see a diagram by the sociologist Kurt Lewin. I don't know how you speak it out. And it's about a social field, the way a husband and a wife are related in the social field. I really don't want to really go into it, but upper left diagram is like the husband in the social field, and there you see W as wife, and it's like his thinking of how she would behave. And the next diagram to it is like the perspective from the wife. And then you have a, like in the middle is a kind of a general thing. And below you see if they don't behave according to certain rules that the marriage would go wrong. So this is a kind of a, like a social study diagram. And Ricardo Bassbaum takes that kind of mapping out a social field by developing all this very open diagrams, which he combines with choreography. So this is a kind of like as well as maps. So this for dancers. So he puts them like in open public spaces, or uses them as a kind of a choreographic devices. And it's all about acknowledging, and this is important, I think also how to think about diagrams and why it has become very popular. It's that everyone is kind of linked. We're living in a connected society, and especially came from Levin, it was a big step taking psychology or mixing psychology with social field theory. So getting away from the individual towards the consideration of being part of a society and being connected and how you behave in that social field. So that's where Bassbaum takes it. Yeah, I think that's already, that's like from the image side. And then there's another contribution by the by Bracha Ettinger, which is a psychoanalyst. And she's based in Tel Aviv and also artist, and who may be known to you by the work of Grisela Pollock, who wrote extensively about her, or Katrin de Seger shows her a lot. And she has she developed a whole theory about relationality, and I think which is in so far interesting that it gives the book at least kind of a feminist shift, because in a way it's interesting, and maybe that's also something we could talk about later. Everyone who thinks about relationality, connectivity, also materiality in a way, stems from is much more acknowledged from a feminist viewpoint than in other kind of philosophies. And she developed a theory which is called matrixial border space, where she emphasizes that borders connect us as well as they separate us. So there's always about this nice connecting questions. And out of that she comes to terms with a theory with an ethical claim, actually, which is about acknowledging the other. But this is not just a theoretical claim or an ethical claim, but she develops that from psychoanalysis, claiming that not only like this primordial split, as Lacan says, but there is a kind of a time we have all been like fetuses at some point, and all experienced a period of not being a person, not being one nor being two. And this possibility of considering like human beings of not being one nor two is that kind of a common ground which she thinks is the kind of a real like residue or kind of a like an experience we all share. And if this would be acknowledged, well, the world would be better. But yeah, it's basically adding a different notion to the Lacanian theory out of the insight that from that theory of split, women are usually considered as a threat or as a threat, actually, because of that not good separation of the mother. So if you don't separate from your mother in a good way, you become either schizophrenic or you are threatened all your life. And her point is that this kind of acknowledgement of that different relation next to the necessity of the split. I was interesting to conceive of that also in a diagrammatical way, talking about connecting. And so, in a way, the book is also an attempt to maybe put something next to what we call relational aesthetics. So it's not about just simply relating to things, but really to think about more complex ways of connection of relationality in a way. So so this is in a way like the outline of the book, and I think the turning point which interests me. And and now maybe I hand over to my colleagues, and we're all thank you very much that you came, and also to Canopy to make that possible here. And we first thought it would be really interesting to first really look at the specific work of artists to see really where they got their ideas from, which they take up. Is it sciences, educational, engineering? So there's a whole different range of diagrams, which are kind of a starting point. And maybe Prudence, if you want to begin. So that said, Earl.
Sure. Can everyone hear me okay? Yeah? Okay, great. First, it's a real pleasure to be a part of this conversation, especially with people who have really helped me think about what a diagram might be art historically and within artwork. And I just have a very, very few notes about the concept of the diagram as we might think through in the case study of one particular artist who's near and dear to me, Ad Reinhardt. And so I just want to sort of very briefly map out three ways that I think we might begin to think about Reinhardt dealing with this idea of the diagram. And those three ways are the diagram as delineation, the diagram as movement, and the diagram as didactic. And perhaps these three sort of very rough subject headings might be helpful in thinking through our conversation later. So I'm actually very interested in the diagram in its most basic Greek roots as delineating that which is marked out by lines. And this question of the line, in particular the nature of lines, is incredibly important to Reinhardt's practice, especially as he, in his development, especially as he was attempting to really get away from the autographic expressive line, as I would argue, and also not just in terms of looking at his abstract canvases and how he maps out color space in them, but actually, and in particular, and I just brought a few images of his cartoon collages today, in his cartoon collages, and I'm in particular looking at the 1946 How to Look at Art series, but also even in his slide photographs too. So this was really, he talks quite a lot in his writing about the idea of intellectually controlling space. And I think this is something that's very much at work here in his interest in the diagram and using the kind of diagrammatic line rather than the expressive line. And in his unpublished notes, the diagram, for those of you who may be aware of Reinhardt's writing and the kind of amazing lists and tautological expressions that he has throughout his writing, the diagram appears in the good, true column of Timeless Art Words. So he very much approved of the diagram. Thinking about the diagram as movement, I think, in a way, one of the reasons why the diagram may have appealed to Reinhardt is that, to me, it seems there's a shift away from a question necessarily of meaning to a question of working through something, to a question of a kind of praxis. So in other words, not necessarily what A or B is, or even what it means to be going from A to B, but how to do it. And I think it's very productive to think about the diagram as a kind of efficiency of movement. And it's no sort of, and that's something we can look at in terms of, and I'm sure that David will be talking about this more, of, how we've thinking through this idea of movement in diagrams, or the most famous diagrams that we can think of in art history in the 20th century. From, of course, the Dada machines all the way to Warhol's dance diagram, et cetera. And it's very interesting that in some of the earliest graphic work that Reinhardt makes for his newspaper graphic illustrations, he's actually literally diagramming movement. He makes a lot of World War II maps Which I'm sorry, I don't have an image of here. And he even has this kind of incredible, he does these wonderful graphic illustrations of different news stories, including one in which he has a wonderful aerial diagram of a Manhattan block and the escape route of a murderer. And then just lastly, actually, one sort of really interesting thing, too, just to point out about his very famous How to Look at Modern Art in America, is that you have this wonderful idea of the participatory as well, which sounds like it's something we might want to talk about, too, in terms of connectivity, where you have these sort of extra leaves up at the top, which you are encouraged to cut out and fill in with your own artist names and then fit where you think they should go on the tree. But maybe to see another image. One of the interesting things too about Reinhardt's use of or interest in the diagram is how he, and it's very obvious from the titles of these How to Look at Art cartoons, is his kind of interest in what we would sort of think of as conservative classic art educational models, rather than a kind of sense of the line or drawing as a kind of spontaneous or inherent trait. And despite the historical context of an increase in diagrams, which several art historians have really interestingly written about in terms of an increase in diagrams accompanying art education reforms and just basic educational reforms beginning after the Civil War until the Great Depression. But also I think that the diagram really did appeal to Reinhardt for its universal and in some ways anachronistic sense too, where it could be so that you have this interest in, for instance, the medieval diagram. And many medieval art historians have talked about the diagram as being the mode of representation for medieval art. And in fact, there's one really interesting study about the importance of the diagram for mapping out theories of perception in medieval art. And this, of course, is very much something that interested Reinhardt, even as we can see in his titles for how to look at different things. So really thinking through these kind of models of perception, too, and the importance of looking. And then just the last image, too. It's one of the ways that I think it's very clear to see this Reinhardt's interest in this idea of intellectually controlling space and really thinking through what the diagram could do is his treatment of Picasso's famous 1937 painting, Guernica, which was one of his, I think, actually the last How to Look at Art cartoon that Reinhardt made. And for those of you who know this series, and even from seeing the other two, it's really actually one of the most kind of straightforward and serious and somber of these cartoon collages. And he really very much here wrests Guernica away from the kind of automatist, expressionist drawing that had been really celebrated by a lot of Reinhardt's colleagues, most famously Jackson Pollock, who had gone multiple times to see all the preparatory sketch drawings that were in New York, and also, of course, to see Guernica at MoMA. And instead, Reinhardt finds it really important to stress the sense of kind of intellectual control and to talk about the way that Picasso is, you know, using deliberately sort of collaging and diagramming this dark age. So he's using this kind of this way of making this drawing and making this painting into through diagram into something that's much more about a kind of intellectually controlled space that was his interest in art history. So I think I'm going to stop there, and then hopefully some of these aspects we can pick up again later.
I thank you, everybody. You're supposed to thank people. Thank you for doing this book, and thank you for your article about Ed Reinhardt and Art Form was really great. I began being interested in diagrams in 2009. I'm going to be very personal. I was actually living in Germany, and I didn't know anyone there. And I was invited to all these dinners all the time, and you know, both art dinners and like these academy dinners, because I was staying at this Berlin Academy. So I just started making parodic seating charts with fake people, and I literally spent like the first, I don't know, I spent 6 months like making fake dinner table diagrams, making up people who were based on people I met and having a completely good time. And at the end of that period of time, I realized that not only were these diagrams, they needed to be in this show. I mean, I make these expressionistic drawings and paintings, but I felt like I needed these diagrams to be in the show with me, because they were actually, they provided a very important aspect of my who I am, which is that I make a lot of jokes. And so I started thinking, actually, like, how are these even remotely different from my paintings? In fact, diagrams are a kind of model for what it's like to make a painting, because even when I make... I got to put the dog down. It's driving me nuts. When you make a painting... I was trying to find a visual form for what it's like... I'm always trying to find a visual form for what it's like to think. That's actually what I think painting is for me. It's a visual theorem for thinking and feeling at one time, those two things at once. And I realized that when I was putting these diagrams, these hilarious things with my paintings, it opened the painting show as an exhibition to a place that was much more where I wanted the painting show to be, where it rested on points that were both social parody, humor, and also aesthetic and beauty and expression and not expression and expression of vulgarity as well as expression of like high-minded modernist aesthetic. So it also made me think about diagrams. The process of doing these table drawings made me think about what I'm doing when I'm painting, and I don't think I'm special. I think I'm probably doing something very similar with history and with memory that most painters are doing, which is that you're thinking while you're making something about the things you've seen and the things that you can remember, and the angle of a shadow and the line of a Matisse and the face that your mother had, and et cetera, et cetera. And you're sort of synthesizing these ill-fitting fragments together in your mind and actually coming up with something that sort of works its way through all of that, but contains all of these irrational, irresolute parts. So I became interested in the idea of a diagram not as a visual thing. I don't really care so much about flowcharts. I don't look at everybody else's diagrams and go, ooh, that's amazing. What I became interested in was not the visual form of a diagram, but the diagram as a model for a particular way of having an art practice, and which is actually what Prudence describes in her Ad Reinhardt article, a recent one in Art Forum, because Ad Reinhardt also did, I guess, you know, she taught me that he did slide talks, and, you know, not only diagrams, but also, and obviously the paintings and drawings, but also cartoons and illustrations for books and all of that. And I felt like a diagram was like a living model which encourages you as an artist to present and contain and change the relations that you have in your studio, and then expose that when you have an exhibition, which I guess some people already do, like conceptual artists already do this, but abstract painters like me may not do that. So the diagram was a model for a way of thinking, which was very important to me. And then I did take this Charles Peirce seminar in Berlin with Susanna, which is how I met her. And I read the Deleuze book about Francis Bacon, thank you, and I certainly reviewed all of the things that I've always loved, which include Picabia, which include experiments that exist between language and image, which contain polarities of time and space and humor and vulgarity and high-mindedness and low-mindedness, and the diagram ultimately became sort of a model of behavior in a way, which changed, which expressed relations and changed relations of making. I the only other thing I wanted to say was that I also realized that, and this has been written quite a bit, but I mean, I think to add to that, a diagram is a picture of a mental space, and it's not a Euclidean perspectival one, and it's not even an optical sort of visual theorem. It's a kind of open plan visual theorem, which is a sort of time-space container, and in that sense, it seemed like it replaces perspective as a 20th century form, which does the same job that perspective perhaps did for the Renaissance, and allows for a kind of model of open action. But when I say that, I also realize that, like, there is this sort of Foucauldian diagram position about knowledge. And what I think is interesting is working with what you don't know, and working with what, in a way, both can't be known or what you particularly don't know. And I think most artists that I know actually do work with that very poignantly. And so when I was thinking of a diagram, I just wanted to add that I was thinking about the way a diagram might be similar to a spider web that comes out of is the ass of the spider or its mouth or something, that, like, a spider web is kind of the diagram that I'm talking about. It's the one that you're making as you go along, which is based on a framework, but which is not necessarily a knowledge-based epistemological framework. It's a body. It's a form which is situated at the hinge between your body and your mind, and that's what I'm interested in about a diagram. Oh, I didn't even show the other pictures. Wait, just flip through. Well, this is a diagram. And that's a diagram. And that's a diagram. Thank you.
Okay. I'll add my thanks. It's nice to be here on a Thursday night. What I'm glad Amy showed her images of the dinner party diagrams, because the first thing that I really wanted to say about diagrams is that they actually host many different, let's say, visual events. I'm not going to say meanings on purpose. What a diagram does is it enables or hosts several itineraries through an image. Instead of what we usually think of an image, or maybe lazily think of an image as doing, which is standing for something. Instead of standing for something, it's a kind of router that allows all kinds of different itineraries. It hosts them in a way. I hadn't thought of the term host, but I decided that it's a nice term given Amy was thinking about dinner parties, and also because a host is a kind of technological term as well. So I think what I'm interested in with regard to diagrams, the thing that most interests me is that it allows many different images to cohabit. They're sort of radically unhierarchical, and also they throw the image into time because it has to be traveled, the diagram, in order to have any real coherence or any use value, I should say. It must move into time. So what I thought I'd do, because we were asked to bring two or three slides, and I'm very literal, I thought I would bring one. I decided to think about what I'm calling three moods of the diagram, which trace a very abbreviated history of the 20th century. So the first is the machine mood, which is the one that I kind of talk about in the essay that is in this book. And I'm not going to say much about it, really. This is a Picabia Dadaist composition from 1919. But to point out that it is interesting that the model of connection, as Susanna was talking about here, and it's interesting to think of these vis-a-vis the Reinhardts too, because instead of a tree, there's this sort of machine. But I think what's very important about the connections that the machine makes in Dada diagrams is that there are always machines that don't function. They're not really functional machines. They're kind of, you know, weird hybrid machines, maybe something like the body-mind monster or a chimera that Amy was talking about. You didn't call it a monster, but it's a kind of, you know, way in which the machine and the body cohabit as well in the same image through an idea of connection. And this also has a didactic, well, I mean, it pretends to have a didactic quality. I thought it would be interesting, this might not be even, oh, you can sort of see it. This is a Solowit. And just to play on the idea of machine, first of all, he famously said in his paragraphs on conceptual art from 1967, the following. I just want to read a little quote from this because it gives a very different, this will sound just like a kind of arbitrary juxtaposition of the same word, perhaps, the same word machine, but I think actually it gives a really good historical reading of how the diagram might shift, or also how the idea of the machine shifts in art of the 20th century. He writes as part of this, I will refer to the kind of art in which I am involved. This is paragraphs on conceptual art. Did I say that already? The kind of art which I am involved as conceptual art. In conceptual art, the idea of a concept is the most important aspect of the work. When an artist uses a conceptual form of art, it means that all of the planning and decisions are made beforehand and that the execution is a perfunctory affair. The idea becomes a machine that makes the art. And then the art is looked for later. It's actually, he doesn't say the art is looked for later. That's a kind of Duchampiana type expression. Duchamp talked about the ready-made as a rendezvous and that would be delayed on some level. So here, the notion of the machine is a set of rules that produces the diagrammatic. In this case, it's one of many of the rule-based systems that Lewitt uses, and I have to read it because I can't ever remember these systems. These, for this particular wall drawing 130, the idea was that these combinations take into account both the type of line, arc, circle, grid, and all the possible points on a wall from which an arc can emanate, the center, the four corners, and the four midpoints of the sides. Many of the combinations, et cetera, et cetera. So here what we have then is the diagrammatic as a process, as a machinic process, is separated from the look of the diagram as a field of directional or vector lines. So I like to think about this as a kind of completely abstract diagram because, in fact, its itineraries are not marked out with any particular points of reference in the way that the Picabia one was, for instance, or for that matter, the Ed Reinhardt ones that Proust showed. So I think that this is a fully abstract form of the diagrammatic, which I, in recent thoughts I've had about Duchamp, would relate to how the large glass as a diagram is separated from its iconography or explanation, the green box, which includes all of his notes, which is reproduced and disseminated as a work. So what stands behind the work, to go back to that paradigm that I introduced my remarks with tonight, what we think stands behind the work, i.e. its meaning, instead shoots away from the work as a work itself. And I think, in a way, this is what conceptual art does. It radically unlinks the kind of discourse that frames the work and the diagram. I would argue that what happens in the 60s, 70s is that diagrams through a certain kind of abstract painting diverge from discourse, which then emerges as conceptual art. So that's, you know, really schematic, and I'm sure we could have a lot of objections to that. But, the third mood of the diagrammatic moves from this evacuation of discourse from the diagram that I described using Lewitt to the introduction of the body in movement from one image to another. In a way, then, this is where images throw people out into space again, which is an idea that I have to say that Rebecca Quaitman has helped me think through, and she's here, so thank you about that. Anyway, I'm calling this relocation and showing you a work of Sherry Levine's that includes four of the same collage of a seascape, because what this work requires one to do if one's game is to move in and out of the same image, to see the single with the multiple or the multitude or the population of images. You can never see the individual image without being conscious of the population. The diagrammatic here is the movement of the body that goes from one to the other, or perhaps just turns on its heel and leaves the gallery, which is another kind of diagram, I suppose. It's an arrow shooting right to the door. So with that, I will end my remarks.
Okay, so maybe, yeah, as was suggested, we have kind of like questions already, like, which popped up, like, just like in the very quick question to you, David. Well, sorry, this is kind of disappearing. why do you call it mood instead of method, for example, or modes?
Oh, okay.
Which is just kind of very...
I think I didn't want to call it method because I think of it as a kind of... We were told to keep these very close to our mouths. That's why I'm, like, turning in this way. I think of it almost as a kind of grammatical... Maybe a better term would be a tense, in the sense of a grammatical tense as opposed to a mood. But I guess I don't feel like they really are methods. I think that they're approaches and they're attitudes. Maybe that's... Probably either attitude or grammatical tense would be a better term than mood. So, yeah.
And it's interesting, too. I mean, the Deleuzean idea of the diagram as a kind of possibility of fact, which it sounds like... sort of the emergence of that possibility, which is something that Amy, I think, talked about too, and that seems to me also to connect to that idea of, rather than sort of wanting to say it's this exact thing, that there is this kind of play that's possible there, mm-hmm. Even if it is also, I think in the case of Reinhardt, about a kind of interest and intellectual control too.
Would you be willing to kind of reflect in public on the sort of relation between the paintings and the diagrams?
that's a very big question.
I know.
Well, I think to keep it very short and related to what we've been talking about thus far tonight, I would maybe just say, and hopefully not repeating myself too much, that I think that there's a way in which, and it's, you know, it is, I think, connected actually to some of these medieval theories of perception too, and kind of thinking through making the invisible visible, or that there, you know, in abstraction there's something more there than can be seen. But that also for Reinhardt's process, it really is, in my view, about this sort of battle with line and this battle with drawing, and really getting as far away as possible from what he found to be as kind of, at least as I interpret it through his writing and through the work that he makes in all different media, a kind of moral problem of expression or of putting a particular meaning into line. And so getting as far away from that idea as possible. So the diagram, as being in some ways a kind of preform, preset idea, allows him to, I think, then begin to uncouple all of these other associations to the point where he can really be working through ideas of space and color rather than a drawn, single line within the works, so that you have... instead, these kind of structures, what I call sort of pure structure, that underlying the abstract paintings. But it is, it's very interesting to think about, you know, in his production at the same time that he's doing these all black or, you know, black paintings, that there are still also, he's really thinking through in the medium of photography, you know, in his writing, very similar structures and viewpoints too. So, I mean, I think that there's, that shouldn't be forgotten either. And much as, you know, Amy was saying that this kind of interest in sort of looking at things, peripheral things, as much as just the kind of central aspect too of what an artist's praxis.
I have a question that I actually was really curious. I hope this is not too much about putting pressure on you to talk about Ed Reinhardt, but it sort of is germane to something I was interested in, which was why, or could you talk about the fact that it seems like these canonical diagrams, which people absolutely love and are very important to modern art, could you talk about the fact that it seems like we don't know about, you know, one doesn't learn about them first? There's not a big book about them. I mean, I have the Ed Reinhardt catalog at my house, and they're not in it, or maybe there's one. I never knew about the, you know, slide talks until I read your article. And, you know, I mean, I feel like what's the deal with this, you know, asymmetrical legacy mm-hmm. of his mm-hmm. work? And did he, I guess most particularly, did he construct that, or was mm-hmm. that something that was constructed against his practice in a way?
That's another really big question. yeah, I think that, well, actually, the good news is that I think in the next 10 years, Alex, I don't know, maybe less than that, I mean, you're going to see a lot more of, I think, publications and dissemination of information about all the different media practices that Reinhardt has. And in part, that's because there's now a formation of the Anne Reinhardt Foundation, and they're putting together what's going to be a really fantastic website, I think, that will have a lot of, that will suddenly bring a lot of exposure to a lot of these materials that have been in some ways, yeah, I think languishing. I mean, when I went to look at the, you know, 12,000 slides, I mean, they're in these 56, you know, metal boxes in storage. And so, I mean, it's going to be very exciting, I think, when they can be seen more. And I think it's just, there's been a kind of, there just needs to be more work and more publications done on Reinhardt, I think. So I think this is, you know, that's...
I still don't understand. But, is that what he wanted?
Right, right. There's the 76, yeah.
Right, but I'm just asking about his role in that. That's what I want to know, is whether he was suppressing that other work or whether that work was being suppressed.
You know, I think that, and also, I mean, the fact that, you know, a lot of these were being published in magazines, I mean, I think it's just in terms of how art history works, maybe what, you know, I mean, frankly, his paintings are not seen enough either. I mean, you know, in most art history sort of textbooks, it's a kind of footnote, or you have like the one black painting illustrating a particular point and then moving on. And I mean, his painting practice is fascinating. And if you, you know, there was the recent Pace show of his early drawings, but, you know, there's been very little work about, you know, multiple periods of his paintings and thinking through some of the connections, for instance, to surrealism. I mean, he has a lot of paintings that are very strange and bright neon colors. And, you know, in part, I think that's because many of these have gone to private collections. And, but yeah, I mean, I think it's, I don't know. I mean, my optimistic answer would be that it's just, there's just a lot more to do. And I do think that there's a renewed interest in thinking through what it means, what an artist's practice means, as not just sort of, you know, being delineated as, okay, Reinhardt's an abstract painter and all we should look at are his abstract paintings, because actually, you know, maybe we can find out interesting things about, you know, any of his, you know, any of these different materials that he's working through with that. But I do, I mean, he worked, he made cartoons, collages for most of his life. He made these cartoons, and he wrote incredibly prolifically all through his life. So, I mean, I think that these are, you know, and I don't think you take as many slide photographs as he did and stage these really interesting slide lectures that he, you know, called his non-happenings and lasted sometimes interminably. And, you know, I don't think that you do these kind of practices if you're not, you know, interested in creating that kind of archive and thinking through that. And that's not to say that I think, you know, they all have sort of necessarily equal footing in terms of how, you know, we want to really think about maybe the history of art or how we would think about, I mean, obviously for him, it was always the most important thing was the abstract paintings for sure. So.
Yeah, but I also have the feeling that this is also like a problem, what you said, of art history. Mm-hmm. That usually art history wants to be sure that it deals with artworks. And so many of the diagrams which were produced, also like it was interesting to read that the Picabia diagrams were produced first for magazines. Mm-hmm. So they were not, I mean, they were produced as artworks, but they circulated in a very different way. And like mostly, but this is also like an important point, like about diagrams, that not every diagram is automatically an artwork. So as Amy pointed out, it's a way of thinking, or as you said, David, it's a way of connectivity as well. So it's not, I mean, I don't want to really end up with a discussion of whether a diagram is art or not. There's a Austrian diagram collector, Gerhard Dirmoser, who made a diagram about whether a diagram is an image or not, and he gathered around like 1,000 answers to that question and making a diagram of that. But still, in a way, I think, still there's also a productivity to think, to not necessarily think about diagrams as an artistic practice. Like, is it, as writing is not nothing as such, or making an image is not nothing as such, but in a way, how artists really like turn diagrams into an artwork. And I think an interesting case in that respect is the work of Mark Lombardi. Because when you go, I looked at the, like his first, like the notes, and they're really like kind of very casually done. I mean, it's really like basically like a line and some notes. And only later he took these graphic devices and kind of really made them aesthetically balanced and blew them up. But the very first one, so to get the information in a way, you don't really need that. But if you want to make an artwork of it, you have to kind of add something to it. But this is a very kind of, I mean, literal notion of the diagram. And I think that that's also, maybe we can, this is just kind of a side, like a footnote to your comment. But Amy, I have a question for you, because you said that you don't look at others' diagrams and say, oh, wow. But we art historians do. So I was thinking, like, I mean, like a painting you did, like draw, seems so much like an adaptation in a way of like early like Picabia and Zayas diagrams, and in a way it's also still a visual form. And for me, it would be interesting to see, like, so since you kind of denied it, it's a visual form. How else would you describe your relation maybe to Picabia or history? And one point. And the other question would be, I mean, these diagrams of Picabia have so much. They have so much to do about like sexualizing the machine. Where would you say, do you take that point of the diagram, which is the kind of body machine connection, which is an important thing? Also, when David, you talk about the spectator entering the room and the diagram would kind of connect the body. Mm-hmm. So in a way, the body seems to play in the more important part in thinking about diagrams than like a pure graphical diagram would allow to think of. So I was wondering, yeah. So, you know, you want to have the question. Not the question is like, what is that So how would you describe your relation to the Picabia diagrams in terms of biomorphism and connecting machine sexuality? How would you say, do you take it further?
Well, I didn't denounce diagrams. I love diagrams. But I mean, I was just saying that, like, I was trying to say that, like, it's not, I mean, obviously we get into this place that's really cliche if it's just that, you know, diagrams are these things with kooky lines and information, you know, or non-information. That's not what I don't think any of us are really interested in. What? Oh, sorry, I thought somebody was. But I mean, I think that, how do I answer? I don't know how to answer the question. I mean, I think that maybe this is not the answer to the question, but it's sort of another node to discuss, which is that in Deleuze, this book on Francis Bacon, he talks about cliché as the first thing that happens before the diagram emerges, and that the diagram is actually a kind of catastrophe, and that the catastrophe sort of wipes out and reforms the cliché. And I mean, I think that you find, I don't know what to say about my own work at all, but or how I would relate to Picabia specifically, but I do think that, like, as I said before, I mean, a diagram is basically the same in a way as an abstraction. You know, it's a way of, like, moving something away from a representation, from a conventional representation, and it's a way of, like, containing conflictual forms of representation in the same container, you know, and I don't know any other way to answer it except for that I certainly hope to somehow be able to hold on to a kind of formal logic and at the same time a sort of sexual tension and at the same time a kind of pictorial straightforwardness and pleasure and at the same time like a kind of a function that destroys and overrides, you know, any kind of logics that are established, you know, while you're making something. And that's why I've been trying to talk about process, you know, just that. And I don't think I'm unusual in this, and I feel a little awkward talking about myself. I think every artist I know starts with something which you could call the stract and then makes it abstract by moving it away from that thing. I mean, and it's about ruining things and wrecking things and not knowing what you're doing. And if you don't, I really believe that that's part of everybody's work. And it's very different to look at the blank page than to look at the picture of the Picabia and, you know, think about it. And I think that we all suffer from the problem of the process of making and then unmaking. And so maybe that is a historical, you know, function that people study when they're studying art history. But I'm just saying in a really personal way, process is the thing that I'm interested in really actually discussing, you know, how much people don't know what they're doing. So I don't know, maybe diagram, maybe just sharp line, maybe there's just something about like a line that goes all the way from one side of the page to the other that's reassuring.
Yeah, maybe I just kind of, sorry, kind of insisted on that because it's really different from, yeah, what like the very, like the graphical notion of a diagram.
Well, I mean, I could say one thing about graphics, like, and surrealism and a lot of other things, is which I just always think that everything comes from me being from Chicago. We went to the same high school. And actually, I think that, like, when you're in Chicago, they tell you that you can make surrealism and it'll be great, and you can make cartoons and that'll be fantastic. You can draw faces and that'll be excellent. And then you go to New York and you're like, you're not supposed to make any pictures, don't make them funny, and don't make them surrealistic. So You know, I mean, there is this kind of perverse refusal and pleasure in something which appears to be information and which is then perverted. And I'm sure that's this exact pleasure of surrealism. But, I mean, in a personal way, there's also the way of being kind of feeling like an outsider and trying to make something that's sensible and has rules and is nice and good and then wrecking it.
Definitely. No, for me it's interesting, like, to also in a way to acknowledge this. I mean, this kind of very different possibility to think of diagrams as you just described, which is a different form of like thinking about what I said at the beginning, relating to things. Because usually in art history, you would say, okay, there's the kind of a reference to Picabia, and then you would point out it, and then you would consider it a reference. But in a way, to relate to as one part of like your image knowledge, and have an associate, like this very kind of an access of associations to it, and a much more, I don't know, effective responding, crossing history, whatever. It's very different from saying, oh, this is just a, it's just the reference. And this, and in a way, this leads me to a question for David. I mean, how you describe, I mean, there's a fourth mood of diagrams in a way in a text. Another text you wrote, in which is this kind of notion of transitivity. And transitivity is something which always implies going from here to somewhere, and including an object. So, I mean, this is the grammatical definition. I mean, you can better put it in English than I can. But so in a way, I just show this image of Jutta Kütter's painting, which I thought is really interesting in this respect, because it alludes to Nicolas Poussin. And usually you would say, okay, a reference is going to Nicolas Poussin and pointing out, okay, there's the connection Jutta Kütter did with Poussin, this and that. But obviously, you can see it on the image. There's a little scene which goes back to one famous painting by Nicolas Poussin. But on the other hand, obviously, it's something about something completely else than just kind of dropping a reference. And referentialism has been such a much a topic of the art of the 90s. And I wonder if we just consider it diagrammatically, in which respect does it shift our relation to other artworks and kind of as a visual field, or the notion of transitivity comes into play. So maybe you can elaborate on this a little bit, because I think this is really a shift of how do we relate and consider artworks.
Okay. Thank you. I think the basic definition of the transitive is it's an action on an object, or an object that is acted upon, transitive action. And so I'm very interested in how the experiences images are subjected to remain in traces in their exhibition. And painting is kind of a recalcitrant version, because paintings don't move on their own usually. They're not, I mean, maybe that's something I thought you were laughing. No, what I think is interesting about the diagrammatic is that, in this regard, is that it's, for me, it's a principle of regulating looking that is encoded in the image. As I sort of said in my remarks, I think what I've been trying to really think about is that images, the way we want to consume them is to see what's behind them, to derive something from them, to like suck their content out as their value. What I think the artists I'm most interested in are doing is instead directing you in and out of the image, perhaps elsewhere. Or, I mean, one of the things I liked about the way you were describing Ed Reinhardt is I think of those paintings as sort of reservoirs of attention, you know, that are so different from the other production that he makes, that they slow you down. So I think that images can regulate your speed of looking, so how to look. You know, that's not a mistake that's what Reinhardt was doing, because it's really about the quality, quantity, speed, direction of attention. Because what I really think has changed is that we've gone from, you know, I mean, it's a long historical process that you could root in the 18th century or you could root in the early 20th century, depending on how you wanted to do it. But I think it's hard to think about images now outside of thinking of populations of images. So in something I've read of yours that, you know, you talked about governmentality, for instance, which is the regulation of populations. And I think that what diagrams do is that they help to regulate populations of images and also moods of looking. That's why I do sort of want to somehow, even though I don't have a good explanation for why, I kind of want to hold on to that idea of mood, or kind of performative way of looking, so that the image is almost didactic, in that it, again, in that it directs you in some ways.
Would you say that it directs you? Also, I got your questions for you. But that also directs you, not in a governmentality way, but maybe, like as Amy pointed out, to something where you may, that you haven't known before, because otherwise it would be, for me, like the image is just kind of a controlling device to kind of keep us all together kind of in a social space and not allowing a disruption of that dominant imperative of connectivity as we kind of face in Facebook, for example. I mean, then I would wonder, where's the kind of disruptive moment?
Are you asking me?
Well, me as well, whoever wants to answer.
Should we
Yeah, sure. Comments, questions, knowledge.
Why now? Why diagrams?
I think it's not all, it's not why now. I think it's why again, maybe.
Yes.
And it could be answered like for very different times. For me, it's well, just at what I said at the beginning, this kind of the promise of order which always fails, which I think is an interesting kind of a motto of a which is kind of true for many things. And on the other hand, I think what is interesting now to think about it is exactly what I said, this kind of imperative of like living in a kind of a network society. So in a way, diagrams seem to be a liberating form in the 70s of thinking, of developing a different mode next to language. Now it seems to be kind of a very dominant mode because it's, yeah, everything is about being connected, being plugged in. But then it's still worthwhile to go back to the 70s and see that their notion of the diagram is not so easy, and it's much more so much more different layers. It's about like what Amy pulled out, this kind of disruptive thing, overthrowing it, which is still a very the question is still how to enact that on a daily basis. But I think that's the question which is fascinating for me. To think about it, and as well as David said, I mean, in a way, it's a little bit tiring to always pull out the content of artworks, and then to say, okay, but there's a different approach to it. There's a kind of an effectivity or effective response to it, as well as an intellectual one, and it's not only about saying, oh yeah, this is about. So all I worked as a critic and still doing it. Yeah, the most loved phrase is this artwork is about. So no, is not there is a different way of thinking about it. So this is one possible answer. Maybe you have others.
But I was also thinking that maybe this is just really obvious, but I was thinking that like maybe there's something really deeply pleasurable about like dealing with your day job. Like in your fancy pants, you know, art making, like time. You know what I mean? Most people I know actually had a job at some point, or they like had to read some stuff and do a report on it, or they had, like, you know what I mean? Like, I was really thinking about, like, how painting for painters is partly built out of, like, looking at other paintings and thinking about the way things look in the world and, you know, or whatever they're doing. I don't know. They're cobbling things together. And one really big part of what I think everyone's cobbling together is the fact that, you know, they're filling out forms, you know, they're, like, pasting up magazines. You know, like, we're all doing this day job-y kind of stuff. And I think it's, like, there's something really delightful about the humility of seeing the dumb shit that you have to do every day, like fill out forms, be the thing that you then see or could value as being, you know, wonderful in a museum. Like the first time I saw Richard Serra, I guess it's Serra, those little grids with those tiny little words pasted in. I mean, I think there's something genuinely liberating about, like, your normal day being what's there. In, you know, in high art. I mean, I know that's, maybe that's really stupid, but... Well, I mean, I just think that, like, if you think of, like, what does Lawrence Wiener, like, you know, look like when you go to the museum? What does, I don't know, what, those Richard Serra poems, what do diagrammatic things that I can quickly think of off the top of my head that often, they seem to come from the 70s, you know? Like, what did that give me when I went to a museum as a young person? Well, it gave me the idea that, like, that my day job produced something that literally visually looked something like what they had made and put in a museum, and that was actually really moving, so that it wasn't like a picture of a horse. You know, it was instead, you know, a list of words. I mean, I'm trying to be really personal, but I think there's something, that's the relations that I'm talking about, which could, you know, be very moving in opening up practices to what you did yesterday. Is that... I don't know. That's like such a dumb thing, but it's kind of like how Cage and, you know, the things you hear on the everyday would have make, you know, could make a huge effect on the way, you know, we would think about sound and music or anything else, you know. I don't know if that's true, but I feel like it's something to do with the everyday.
Okay, I have a question in the back.
When I think about diagrams,
I got, well, excuse me, on what?
A.B. Warburg.
Oh.
Warburg.
To me, that's sort of an important part of diagramming art.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we didn't really talk about that much is sort of genealogies of art history and the whole tradition, of course, with Warburg, but also Barr's famous diagram of abstract art, and then, which is something that, of course, the Fluxus artists also play on. And in terms of Reinhardt, I mean, I think that the Nemesine project is incredibly important for him in terms of thinking through his archive of slide photographs, because he collected, he was going all around the world taking pictures of art historical landmarks and putting them together and then sort of showing them in these slideshows that were not necessarily chronological or about even one particular place or theme, but actually, you know, about particular styles and thinking through different kind of ways that the work moved him in terms of its relationship, usually formal. So, and I think there is a really, you know, a very personal, an idea about a very personal diagramming of images, which, you know, we could, I guess, take and, you know, think about in terms of today also the kind of options we have for thinking through information is beautiful, you know, ideas through, you know, pinning images and how we collect images in these very public databases for people to see and as a kind of way of, in some ways, representing ourselves, right? And which I think is a very interesting way of diagramming the self without being present at all.
Could I just make one quick remark to that? Because I think that, you know, what his projects show is a kind of spatial way of producing knowledge as opposed to a narrative, a linguistic narrative way, which tends to, you know, have to be linear on some level. Of course, there are literary experiments that break that down, but that's not usually within the context of art criticism or art history. And so I think that there are a lot of really interesting projects to make knowledge that is spatialized as opposed to narrated. And I think of Foucault, actually, even though he uses text, I think of his texts as really being not panoptic, but they often have a shape. The argument has a kind of shape. And that doesn't feel like a through line in the same way as one often gets. And so I think that's one of the kind of use values of diagrams, really. It's a different, it's a spatial form of knowledge.
Yeah, and maybe I can also, I actually, this is a nice way to put think about diagrams in Warburg. But like the concept of the Patches formula and why, in a way, the panels were put together, I necessarily wouldn't consider it as primarily diagrammatic, because in a way it was about finding one consistent form which can be is a means of expression through many, many years, centuries. But it's not so much about... in a way, it's not so much about linking different aspects of things together, but can, in a way, it's more about visual analogies and similarities, in a way. I mean, you can think of that as diagrammatic, but I think more important was to find, in a way, that one form which makes possible to be like a form of expression people always go back to. And in a way, this is almost the opposite of a diagram. I don't know whether you agree, but this, in a way, it would be feel strange for me to only consider them as primarily diagrammatic.
Yeah. I thought it was really interesting in what you said about diagrams as abstractions. And I guess I was thinking about that mostly because as I was looking at the diagrams on the slide projector, I couldn't read any of them. And so I sort of, I was kind of annoyed by that at first.
I'm sorry, thinking, why am I annoyed by what?
Annoyed by the fact that I couldn't read any of the diagrams.
Read them.
And I was, pardon?
You mean read, like, what any of them said?
Yeah, because the writing was too small.
And too much, maybe.
But then I started to think about why am I annoyed? Because I can't read this diagram. And I realized it's, for me at least, it's because the diagram is sort of presenting this fantasy of comprehensibility, as if, like, if only I could read all of this, I would suddenly understand what this is representing. And I guess it reminded me a little bit of the relief I felt when I first saw Alfred Barr's diagram of 20th century art, and I thought, oh, okay, it's all here. Like, I just need to learn this, and then I'll understand. But I guess the larger question is, are diagrams adequate to represent anything, or are they always reductive? Or is there a diagram that's more complicated than the thing that it's trying to represent?
Well, I mean, it depends on the diagram.
Well, like, what does that mean?
I mean, they're yeah, in a way that's, yeah. I mean, they're, I mean, it really depends on the diagram. I mean, like, the bar is certainly reductive, but... But I think, as we pointed out, it's not in a way it distorts the notion of representation at all. Many diagrams in sciences try to be complete, try to be comprehensive. I mean, that's in a way the reason why they are made for. And I think what we all were trying to say, in a little bit like in art, it tries to overthrow that notion. And it's about maybe not being comprehensive, and it's very short. My voice is kind of going down, but yeah, maybe you want to add something.
I saw a great diagram last week that Andrea Geyer showed that was the diagram of modern art without men, and there was which was really good actually. And that's an instance where a diagram is a sort of prosthetic for seeing a reality that you wouldn't otherwise see, because you're not going to see that anywhere else or very few other places. But the diagram lets you think something that you may not be able to see in physical space, and that's a really, really big payoff, you know, sometimes.
Yeah, we can. Well, if there is there a last very urgent question, if not, we just would kind of invite you to discuss with us in, like, with a beer or standing around or.